Blue Mars, Cassette 11. The train skirted the first curved headwalls of the labyrinth of night's sapped canyons, and soon it floated into Cairo's old station. Nergal walked out into the tented town, looking around curiously. It had been a Medinat stronghold, and he had never been in it before. Interesting to see the little old buildings. The physical plant had been damaged by the Red Army and the Revolution and was still marked by broken black walls. People waved at him as he walked down the broad central boulevard to the city offices. And there she was, in the concourse of the town hall, by the window walls overlooking the yew of Nilus Noctis. Nergal stopped, breath short. She hadn't yet seen him. Her face was rounder, but otherwise she was as tall and sleek as ever, dressed in a green silk blouse and a darker green skirt of some coarser material, her black hair a shiny mane spilling down her back. He couldn't stop looking at her. Then she saw him and flinched ever so slightly. Perhaps the wrist images hadn't been enough to tell her how much the Terran illness had hurt him. Her hands extended on their own recognizance, and then she followed them, hands still out even while her eyes were calculating. Her grimace set his appearance, carefully rearranged for the cameras that were always around her. But he loved her for those hands. He could feel the warmth of his face, blushing as they kissed, cheek to cheek, like friendly diplomats. Up close, she still looked 15 years old, just past the unblemished bloom of youth. At that point, that's even more beautiful than youth. People said she had taken the treatment from the age of 10. "It's true, then," she said. "Earth almost killed you." "A virus, actually." She laughed, but her eyes kept their calculating look. She took him by the arm, led him back to her entourage like a blind man. Though he knew several of them, she made introductions anyway, just to emphasize how much the inner circle of the party had changed since he had left. But of course he couldn't notice that, and so he was busy being cheerful when the proceedings were interrupted by a great wail. There was a baby among them. "Ah," Jackie said, checking her wrist, "she's hungry. Come meet my daughter." She walked over to a woman holding a swaddled babe. The girl was a few months old, fat-jowled, darker-skinned than Jackie, her whole face bright with squalling. Jackie took her from the woman and carried her off into an adjacent room. Nergal left standing there, saw Tiu and Rachel and Franz next to the window. He went over to them, glanced in Jackie's direction. They rolled their eyes, shrugged. Jackie wasn't saying who the father was, Rachel said in a quick undertone. It was not unique behavior. Many women from Dorsa Brevia had done the same. The woman who had been holding the girl came out and told Nergal that Jackie would like to speak with him. He followed the woman into the next room. The room had a picture window overlooking Nilus Noctis. Jackie was seated in a window seat, nursing the child and looking at the view. The child was hungry, eyes closed, latched on, sucking hard, squeaking, tiny fists clenched in some kind of arboreal remnant behavior, clutching to branch or fur. That was all culture right there in that clutch. Jackie was issuing instructions to aides both in the room and on her wrist. "No matter what they say in Bern, we need to have the flexibility to dampen the quotas if we need to. The Indians and Chinese will just have to get used to it." Some things began to clarify for Nergal. Jackie was on the executive council, but the council wasn't particularly powerful. She was also still one of the leaders of the Free Mars Party. And although Free Mars might have less influence on the planet, as power shifted out into the tents in Earth-Mars relations, it had the potential to become a determining body. Even if it only coordinated policy, it would gain all the power that a coordinator could command, which was considerable. It was all the power Nergal had ever had, after all. In many situations, such coordination could be the equivalent of making Mars's Terran policy, as all the local governments attended to their local concerns, and the global legislature was more and more dominated by a Free Mars-led supermajority. And of course, there was a sense in which the Earth-Mars relationship had the potential to dwarf everything else, so that Jackie might be on the way to becoming an interplanetary power. Nergal's attention returned to the baby at her breast, the Princess of Mars. "Have a seat," Jackie said, indicating the bench beside her with her head. "You look tired." "I'm fine," Nergal said, but sat. Jackie looked up at one of the aides and jerked her head to the side, and very soon they were alone in the room with the infant. "The Chinese and Indians are thinking of this as empty new land," Jackie said. "You can see it in everything they say. They're too damned friendly." "Maybe they like us," Nergal said. Jackie smiled, but he went on. "We help them get the Metanats off their backs, and they can't be thinking of moving their excess population here. There's just too many of them for emigration to make any difference." "Maybe so, but they can dream. And with space elevators, they can send a steady stream. It adds up quicker than you would think." Nergal shook his head. "It'll never be enough." "How do you know?" "You didn't go to either place." "A billion is a big number, Jackie. Too big a number for us to properly imagine. And Earth has got 17 billion. They can't send a significant fraction of that number here. There aren't the shuttles to do it." "They might try anyway. The Chinese flooded Tibet with Han Chinese, and it didn't do a thing to relieve their population problems, but they kept doing it anyway." Nergal shrugged. "Tibet is right there. We'll keep our distance." "Yes," Jackie said impatiently, "but that's not going to be easy when there is no we. If they go out to Margaritifer and cut a deal with the Arab caravans out there, who's going to stop it from happening?" "The environmental courts?" Jackie blew air between her lips, and the baby pulled off and whimpered. Jackie shifted the infant to the other breast. Blue-veined olive curve. "Antar doesn't think the environmental courts will be able to function for long. We had a fight with them while you were gone, and we only went along with them to give the process a chance, but they made no sense and they had no teeth. And everything everyone does has an environmental impact, so supposedly they should be judging everything. But tents are coming down in the lower elevations, and not one in 100 is going to the courts to ask permission for what they do once their town is part of the outside. Why should they? Everyone is an echo poet now. No, the court system isn't going to work." "You can't be sure," Nergal said. "So is Antar the father, then?" Jackie shrugged. "Anyone could be the father. Antar, Dao, Nergal himself. Hell, John Boone could be, if any sample of his sperm had happened to be still in storage." "That would be like Jackie, except she would have told everyone." She shifted the infant's head toward her. "Do you really think it's all right to raise a fatherless child?" "That's how you were raised, right? And I had no mother. We were all one-parent children."
"But was that good?"
"Who knows?" There was a look on Jackie's face that Nergal couldn't read. Her mouth was just slightly tight with resentment, defiance. Impossible to say. She knew who both her parents were, but only one had stuck around, and Kasei hadn't been much around at that. And killed in Sheffield, in part because of the brutal response to the red assault that Jackie herself had advocated. She said, "You didn't know about Coyote until you were 6 or 7, isn't that right?"
"True, but not right."
"What?"
"It wasn't right."
And he looked her in the eye. But she looked away, down at the baby. "Better than having your parents tearing each other up in front of you."
"Is that what you would do with the father?"
"Who knows?"
"So it's safer this way."
"Maybe it is. Certainly there's a lot of women doing it this way."
"In Dorsa Brevia."
"Everywhere. The biological family isn't really a Martian institution, is it?"
"I don't know."
Nergal considered it. "Actually, I saw a lot of families in the canyons. We come from an unusual group in that respect."
"In many respects." Her child pulled away, and Jackie tucked her breast in her bra and let down her shirt. "Marie," she called, and her assistant entered. "I think her diaper needs changing." And she handed the infant up to the woman, who left without a word. "Servants now?" Nergal said. Jackie's mouth went tight again, and she stood, calling, "Mem?" Another woman came in, and Jackie said, "Mem, we're going to have to meet with those environmental court people about this Chinese request. It could be that we can use it as leverage to get the Cairo water allotment reconsidered." Mem nodded and left the room. "You just make the decisions," Nergal said. Jackie dismissed him with a wave of the hand. "Nice to have you back, Nergal, but try to catch up, all right?" Catch up. Free Mars was now a political party, the biggest on Mars. It hadn't always been that way. It had begun as something more like a network of friends, or the part of the underground that lived in the demimonde. Mostly ex-students of the university in Sabashii, or later, the members of a very loose association of communities in the tented canyons and in clandestine clubs in the cities and so forth. A kind of vague umbrella term for those sympathetic to the underground, but not followers of any more specific political movement or philosophy. Just something they said, in fact. Free Mars. In many ways, it had been Nergal's creation. So many of the natives had been interested in autonomy, and the various Issei parties, based on the thoughts of one early settler or another, didn't appeal to them. They had wanted something new. And so Nergal had traveled around the planet and stayed with people who organized meetings or discussions, and this had gone on for so long that eventually people wanted a name. People wanted names for things. And so, Free Mars. And in the revolution, it had become a rallying point for the natives, rising up out of society as a kind of emergent phenomenon, with many more people declaring themselves members than one would have guessed possible. Millions, the native majority. The very definition of the revolution, in fact. The main reason for its success. Free Mars as a sentence. An imperative. And they had done it. But then Nergal had left for Earth, determined to make their case there. And while he was gone, during the Constitutional Congress, Free Mars had gone from a movement to an organization. That was fine. It was the normal course of events, a necessary part of institutionalizing their independence. No one could complain about it, or moan for the good old days, without revealing nostalgia for a heroic age that hadn't actually been heroic, or, along with heroic, had been also suppressed, limited, inconvenient, and dangerous. No, Nergal had no desire for nostalgia. The meaning of life lay not in the past, but in the present. Not in resistance, but in expression. No, he did not want it to be like it had been before. He was happy they were in control, at least partially, of their fate. That wasn't the problem. Nor was he bothered by the tremendous growth in the numbers of supporters Free Mars had. The party seemed on the edge of becoming a supermajority, with 3 of the 7 executive councillors coming from the party leadership, and most other global positions filled by other members. And now a fair percentage of new emigrants were joining the party, and old emigrants as well, and natives who had supported smaller parties before the revolution, and, last but not least, quite a few people who had supported the Junta regime and were now looking for the new power to follow. All in all, it made for a huge group. And in the first years of a new socio-economic order, this massing of political power, of opinion and belief, had some advantages, no doubt about it. They could get things done. But Nergal wasn't sure he wanted to be a part of it. One day, walking the city wall, looking out through the tenting, he watched a group of people standing on a launch pad at the edge of the cliff west of town. There were a number of different kinds of single-flyer craft, gliders and ultralights that were shot out of a slingshot launcher and rose inside the thermals that formed in the mornings, smaller hang gliders, and then a variety of new one-person aircraft, which looked like small gliders connected to the undersides of small blimps. These flyers were only a bit longer than the people who climbed into the slings or seats under the gliders' wings. Clearly, they were made of ultralight materials. Some were transparent and nearly invisible, so that once in the sky it appeared that prone or seated people were floating around on their own. Other machines had been colored and were visible from kilometers away as strokes of green or blue in the air. The stubby wings had small ultralight jets attached to them so that the pilots had control of the direction and altitude. They were like planes in that respect, but with the added loft of a blimp to make them safer and more versatile. Their pilots landed them almost anywhere, and it looked impossible to dive them, to crash, in other words. The hang gliders, on the other hand, looked as dangerous as ever. The people who used those were the rowdiest members of the flying crowd Nergal could see when he went out there. Thrill-seekers who ran off the edge of the cliff shouting in an adrenalated exhilaration that crackled over the intercoms. They were running off a cliff, after all, and no matter what rig they were strapped to, their bodies still saw what was happening. No wonder their shouts had that special ring. Nergal got on the subway and went out to the launch pad, drawn by some quality of the sight. All those people, free in the sky. He was recognized, of course. He shook hands and accepted an invitation from a group of flyers to go up and see what it was like. The hang gliders offered to teach him to fly, but he laughed and said he would try the little blimp gliders first. There was a two-person blimp glider tethered there, slightly larger than the rest, and a woman named Monica invited him up, fueled the thing, and sat him beside her. And up the launch mast they went, to be released with a jerk into the strong downslope afternoon winds and over the city, now revealed as a small tent filled with greenery, perched on the edge of the northwesternmost of the network of canyons etching the slope of Tharsis. Flying over Noctis Labyrinthus. The wind keened over the blimp's taut transparent material, and they bounced unpredictably up and down on the wind, while also rotating horizontally in what seemed an uncontrolled spin. But then Monica laughed and began manipulating the controls before her, and quickly they were proceeding south across the labyrinth, over canyon after canyon, making their irregular X-intersections. Then over the Compton Chaos and the torn land of the Illyrian Gate, where it dropped into the upper end of the Marineris Glacier. "These things' jets are much more powerful than they need to be," Monica told him through their headphones. "You can make headway into the wind until it reaches something like 250 kilometers an hour, although you wouldn't want to try that. You also use the jets to counteract the blimp's loft to get us back down. Here, try it. That's left jet throttle, that's right, and here are the stabilizers. The jets are dead easy, it's using the stabilizer that needs some practicing." In front of Nergal was a complete second set of controls. He put his hands on the jet throttles, gave them pushes. The blimp veered right, then left. "Wow! It's fly-by-wire, so if you tell it to do something disastrous, it'll just cut out. How many hours flying time do you need to learn this?" "You're doing it already, right?" she laughed. "No, it takes 100 hours or so. Depends on what you mean by knowing how to do it. There's the death mesa between 100 hours and 1,000 hours, after people have relaxed and before they're really good, so that they get into trouble. But that's mostly hang gliders anyway. With these, the simulators are just like the real thing, so you can put in your hours on those, and then when you're actually up here, you'll have it wired even though you haven't officially reached the flying time limit." Interesting. And it was. The intersecting sapped canyons of Noctis Labyrinthus lying under them like an enormous maze, the sudden lifts and drops as the winds tossed them, the loud keening of the wind over their partially enclosed gondola seats. It's like becoming a bird. Exactly. And some part of him saw it was going to be all right. The heart is pleased by one thing after another. After that, he spent time in a flight simulator in the city, and several times a week he made a date with Monica or one of her friends and went out to the cliff's edge for another lesson. It wasn't a complicated business, and soon he felt that he could try a flight on his own. They cautioned him to be patient. He kept at it. The simulators felt very much like the real thing. If you tested them by doing something foolish, the seat would tilt and bounce very convincingly. More than once he was told the story of the person who had taken an ultralight into such a disastrous death spiral that the simulator had torn off its mountings and crashed through the glass wall next to it, cutting some bystanders and breaking the flyer's arm. Nergal avoided that kind of error, and most others as well. He went to Free Mars meetings in the city offices almost every morning and flew every afternoon. As the days passed, he discovered that he was dreading the morning meetings. He only wanted to fly. He hadn't founded Free Mars, no matter what they said. Whatever he had been doing in those years, it was not politics, not like this. Maybe it had had a political element to it, but mostly he had been living his life and talking to people in the Demimond and the surface cities about how to live theirs and still have some freedoms, some pleasures. Okay, it had been political, everything was, but it seemed he wasn't really interested in politics. Or perhaps it was government. It was particularly uninteresting, of course, when dominated by Jackie and her crew. That was politics of a different kind. He had seen from his first moment back that for Jackie's inner circle, his return from Earth was no welcome thing. He had been gone for almost an M-year, and during that time a whole new group had risen to the fore, vaulted by the revolution. Nergal, to them, was a threat to Jackie's control of the party and to their influence on Jackie. They were firmly, if subtly, against him. No. For a time he had been the native's leader, the charismatic of the tribe made up of the indigenous people of Mars, son of Hiroko and Coyote, a very potent, mythic parentage, very hard to oppose. But that time had passed. Now Jackie was in control. And against him she had her own mythic parentage, her descent from John Boone, as well as their shared zygote beginnings, and also the partial backing of the Minoan cult in Dorsa Brevia. Not to mention her direct power over him in their own intense dynamic. But her advisors couldn't understand that, or even fully be aware of it. To them, he was a threatening power, by no means finished because of his Terran illness. A threat forever to their native queen. So he sat through morning meetings in the city offices, trying to ignore their little maneuverings, trying to focus on the issues coming in from all over the planet, many of them having to do with land problems or wrangles. Many tent towns wanted to take down their tents when air pressures made it possible, and hardly any of them were willing to concede that this was an operation in which the environmental courts had a say. Some areas were arid enough that water was the critical issue, and their requests for a water allotment were pouring in, until it seemed that the Northern Sea could be drawn down a kilometer merely by pumping it out to thirsty cities in the south. These and a thousand more matters tested the Constitution's many networks for connecting local autonomy to global considerations. The debates would go on forever. Nergal, while fundamentally uninterested in most of these wrangles, found them yet preferable to the party politics he saw going on in Cairo. He had come back from Earth without any official position in the new government or the old party. And one thing he saw going on these days was the struggle to place him, to give him a job with limited power, or, for his backers, or rather Jackie's opponents, to put him in a position with some real power to it. Some friends advised him to wait and run for the Senate when the next elections came. Others mentioned the Executive Council, others party positions, others a post on the GEC. All these jobs sounded awful to Nergal in one way or another, and when he talked to Nadia on the screens, he could see that he would find them a burden. Though she seemed to be hammering away stolidly enough, it was obvious the executive council was distasteful to her. But he kept a straight face and listened closely as people offered their advice. Jackie herself kept her own counsel. In meetings where people suggested that Nergal become a kind of minister without portfolio, she regarded him more blankly than usual, which led Nergal to think that she liked that possibility least of all. She wanted him pinned into some position which, given her current post, couldn't help but be inferior to hers. But if he stayed outside the system entirely... There she sat, the infant in her arms. It could be his child. And Antar watched her with the same expression, the same thought. No doubt Dao would have as well, if he were still alive. Nergal was suddenly shaken by a spasm of grief for his half-brother, his tormentor, his friend. He and Dao had fought for as far back as he could remember, but they had been brothers for all that. Jackie had apparently forgotten Dao already, and Kasei as well, as she would forget Nergal if he should happen to get killed. She had been among the Greens who had ordered the crushing of the Red Assault on Sheffield. She had advocated the strong response. Perhaps she had to forget the dead. The infant cried, face rounded by fat. It was impossible to see any resemblance to any adult. The mouth looked like Jackie's. Other than that, it was frightening, this power created by anonymous parenting. Of course, a man could do the same, obtain an egg, grow it by ectogenesis, raise it himself. No doubt it would begin to happen, especially if many women took Jackie's route. A world without parents. Well, friends were the real family. But he shuddered nevertheless at what Hiroko had done. What Jackie was doing. He went flying to clear his mind of all that. One night after a glorious flight in the clouds, sitting in the launchpad pub, the conversation turned and someone mentioned Hiroko's name. I hear she's on Elysium, someone said, working on a new commune of communes up there. How did you hear? Nergal demanded of the woman, somewhat sharply, no doubt. Surprised, she said, you know those flyers who dropped in last week, who are flying around the world? They were on Elysium last month, and they said they saw her there. She shrugged. That's all I know. Not much by way of confirmation, I know. Nergal sat back in his seat. Always third-hand information. Some of the stories, however, seemed so like Hiroko, and a few... too Hiroko-like to have been made up. Nergal didn't know what to think. Very few people seemed to think she was dead. Sightings of the rest of her group were reported as well. They just wish she were here, Jackie said when Nergal mentioned it the next day. Don't you wish it? Of course, though she didn't. But not enough to make up stories about it. You really think they're all made up? I mean, who would do that? What would they be telling themselves when they did it? It doesn't make sense. People don't make sense, Nergal. You have to learn that. People see an elderly Japanese woman somewhere, they think, that looks like Hiroko. That night they tell their roommates, I think I saw Hiroko today. She was down in the marketplace buying plums. The roommate goes to his construction site, says, my roommate saw Hiroko yesterday buying plums. Nergal nodded. It was no doubt true, at least for most of the stories. For the rest, though, the few that didn't fit that pattern. Meanwhile, you have to make a decision about this environmental court position, Jackie said. It was a province court, one below the global court. We can arrange it so that Mem gets a position in the party that will actually be more influential, or you could take that one if you wanted, or both, I suppose. But we have to know. Yeah, yeah. People came in wanting to talk about something else, and Nergal withdrew to the window near the nurse and the infant. He wasn't interested in what they were doing, not any of it. It was both ugly and abstract, a continuous manipulation of people devoid of any of the tangible rewards that so much work had. "That's politics," Jackie would say. And it was clear she enjoyed it. But Nergal didn't. It was strange. He had worked all his life for this situation, ostensibly, and now that it was here, he didn't like it. Very possibly he could learn enough to do the work. He would have to overcome the hostility of the people who didn't want him back in the party. He would have to build his own power base, meaning collecting a group of people who would help him in their official positions, do them favors, curry their favor, play them off against each other so that each would do his bidding in order to establish preeminence over the others. He could see all these processes at work right there in this very room as Jackie met with one advisor after the next, discussing whatever issue happened to be their bailiwick, then working them to establish more firmly their allegiance to her. "Of course," she would say if he pointed out this process. "That was politics." They were in control of Mars now, and this work had to be done if they were to create the new world they had hoped for. One couldn't be over-fastidious. One had to be realistic. You held your nose and did it. It had a certain nobility to it, really. It was the necessary work. Nergal didn't know if those justifications were true or not. Had they really worked all their lives to overthrow Terran domination of Mars only in order to put in place their own local version of the same thing? Could politics ever be anything but politics? Practical, cynical, compromised, ugly? He didn't know. He sat in the window seat looking down at Jackie's daughter's face, sleeping. Across the room, Jackie was intimidating the Free Mars delegates from Elysium. Now that Elysium was an island surrounded by the Northern Sea, they were more determined than ever to take control of their fate, including immigration limits that would keep the Massif from developing much past its current state. "All very well," Jackie was saying, "but it's a very large island now, a continent, really, surrounded by water so that it will be especially humid, with a coastline of thousands of kilometers, lots of fine harbor sites, fishing harbors, no doubt. I can sympathize with your desire to keep a hand on development. We all feel that. But the Chinese have expressed a particular interest in developing some of these sites, and what am I supposed to say to them? That the Elysian locals don't like Chinese? That we'll take their help in a crisis, but we don't want them moving into the neighborhood?" "It's not that they're Chinese," the delegate said. "I understand. Really, I do. Tell you what. You go back to South Fossa and explain the difficulties we face here, and I'll do everything I can here to help you. I can't guarantee results, but I'll do what I can." "Thanks," the delegate said, and left. Jackie turned to her assistant. "Idiot. Who's next?" "Ah, naturally, the Chinese ambassador. Well, let him in." The Chinese, a woman, was quite tall. She spoke in Mandarin, and her AI translated into a clear British English. After an exchange of pleasantries, the woman asked about establishing some Chinese settlements, preferably somewhere in the equatorial provinces. Nergal stared, fascinated. This was how settlements had been started from the very beginning. Groups of Terran nationals had come up and built a tent town or a cliff dwelling or domed a crater. Now, however, Jackie looked polite and said, "It's possible. Everything, of course, will have to be referred to the environmental courts for judgment. However, there is a great deal of empty land on the Elysium Massif. Perhaps something could be arranged there, especially if China was willing to contribute to infrastructure and mitigation and the like." They discussed details. After a while, the ambassador left. Jackie turned to look at Nergal. "Nergal, could you get Rachel in here and try to decide what you're going to do soon, please?" Nergal walked out of the building through the city to his room. He packed his little collection of clothes and toiletries and took the subway out to the launching pad and asked Monica for the use of one of the single-person blimp gliders. He was ready for soloing. He had put in enough hours in simulators and with teachers. There was another flight school down in Marineris on Kander Mensa. He talked to the school officials on the launch pad. They were willing to let him take the blimp glider down there and have it returned by another flyer later. It was midday. The Tharsis downslope winds had started and would only get stronger as the afternoon progressed. Nergal suited up, got into the pilot's seat. The little blimp glider slid up the launching mast, held by the nose, and was let free. He rose over Noctis Labyrinthus, turned east. He flew east over the maze of interlocking canyons, a land split open by stress from below. Flight out of the labyrinth. An Icarus who had flown too close to the sun, gotten burned, survived the fall, and now flew again, this time down, 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 ever down, taking advantage of a hard tailwind, riding a gale, shooting down over the shattered, dirty ice field that marked Compton Chaos, where the Great Channel outbreak had begun in 2061. That immense flood had run down Ias Chasma, but Nergal angled north, away from the glacier's flow, and then flew east again, down into the head of Tithonium Chasma, which paralleled Ias Chasma just to the north. Tithonium was one of the deepest and narrowest of the Marineris canyons, 4 kilometers deep, 10 wide. He could fly well below the level of the plateau rims and still be thousands of meters over the canyon floor. Tithonium was higher than Ias, wilder, untouched by human hands, seldom traveled in because it was a dead end to the east, where it narrowed and became rough-floored as it got shallower, then abruptly stopped. Nergal spotted the road that switched back up the eastern headwall, a road he had traveled a few times in his youth when all the planet had been his home. The afternoon sun dipped behind him. The shadows on the land lengthened. The wind continued to blow strong, thrumming over the blimp glider, whining and whooshing and keening. It blew him over the cap rock of the rim plateau again, as Tithonium became a string of oval depressions, pocking the plateau one after the next, the Tithonia Catena, each dip a giant bowl-shaped depression in the land. And then suddenly the world dropped away again, and he flew out over the immense open canyon of Kander Chasma, Shining Canyon. The ramparts of its eastern wall, in fact, shining at that very moment, amber and bronze in the sunset's light. To the north was the deep entrance to Ophir Chasma, to the south the spectacular buttress-walled opening down to Mellus Chasma, the central giant of the Marineris system. It was Mars's version of Concordia Plots, he saw, but much bigger than Earth's, wilder, looking untouched, primal, gigantic beyond all human scale, as if he had flown back 2 centuries into the past, or 2 eons, to a time before the anthropogenesis. Red Mars. And there, out in the middle of broad Kander, was a tall diamond mesa, a caprock island standing nearly 2 kilometers above the canyon floor. And in the sunset's hazy gloom, Nergal could make out a nest of lights, a tent town at the southernmost point of the diamond. Voices welcomed him over the common band on his intercom, then guided him into the town's landing pad. The sun was winking out over the cliffs to the west as he brought the blimp glider around and descended slowly into the wind, putting it down right on the figure of Cocopelli painted as a target on the landing pad. Shining Mesa had a large top, more like a kite shape than a diamond proper, 30 kilometers long and 10 wide, standing in the middle of Kander Chasma like a Monument Valley mesa writ large. The tent town occupied only a small rise on the southern point of the kite. The mesa was just what it appeared to be, a detached fragment of the plateau that the Marineris canyons had split. It was a tremendous vantage point for viewing the great walls of Kander, with views through the deep, steep gaps into Ophir Chasma to the north and Mellus Chasma to the south. Naturally, such a spectacular prospect had attracted people over the years, and the main tent was surrounded by new, smaller ones. At 5 kilometers above the datum, the town was still tented, though there was talk of removing it. The floor of Kander Chasma, only 3 kilometers above the datum, was patched with growing dark green forests. Many of the people who lived on Shining Mesa flew down into the canyons every morning to farm or botanize, floating back up to the mesa's top in the late afternoons. A few of these flying foresters were old underground acquaintances of Nergal's, and they were pleased to take him along and show him the canyons and what they did in them. The Marineris Canyon floors generally run down west to east. In Kander, they curved around the Great Central Mesa, then fell precipitously south into Mellis. Snow lay on the higher parts of the floor, especially under the western walls where shadows lay in the afternoon. Meltwater from this snow ran down in a faint tracery of new watersheds made up of sandy braided streambeds that ran together into a few shallow, muddy red rivers which collected at a confluence just above the Kander Gap and poured down in a wild foaming rapids to the floor of Mellis Chasma, where it pooled against the remnant of the 61 glacier, running redly against its northern flank. On the banks of all these opaque red streams, forest galleries were springing up. They consisted in most places of cold-hardened balsas and other very rapidly growing tropical trees, creating new canopies over older krumholz. These days it was warm on the canyon floor, which was like a big sun-reflecting bowl protected from the wind. The balsa canopies were allowing a great number of plant and animal species to flourish underneath them. Nergal's acquaintances said it was the most diverse biotic community on Mars. They had to carry sedative dart guns now when they landed and walked around because of bears, snow leopards, and other predators. Walking through some of the galleries was becoming difficult because of thickets of snow bamboo and aspen.
This ends side one of cassette 11. Please turn the cassette over and start side two at the same point.